TV commentator to talk a bit about life and about faith. And he said, I would think that the greatest test of a person's faith is when a loved one is afflicted by some disease or is suddenly stricken down. At a time like that, even an agnostic has to ask what kind of celestial crap game is going on. I think Walter Cronkite was onto something. If you're going to talk about living a holy life, it comes most difficult, I think, when some tragedy touches you, or even worse, touches someone that you love. When you see someone that you know who is righteous and honorable suffering, you can't help but wonder what kind of celestial crap game is taking place. For a while, I have lived with a man who endured a series of tragedies in his life. He was a godly man. Joe had a reputation for integrity and uprightness. What was impressive is that he had made his mark in the field of business. He had done well in agriculture. Not only did he own a great deal of land, but he owned a great deal of the livestock on the land. He was sometimes called a tycoon, and he was one of the most successful businessmen in the eastern part of the country. What I admired about Joe was that in spite of the mark he'd made in business, he had kept his principles straight, and he had not confused his priorities. He was a family man. In fact, he and his wife loved children, and they actually had 10 of them, 7 boys and 3 girls. Because he was a man of means, he was able to give his children everything they needed, the best of schooling, a secure home, and most of all, a home in which God was honored. And the young people were surrounded by lives of faith. He was admired in the community of faith and in the broader community. He was a man of principle, and he was a success. And then a series of tragedies happened in Joe's life. First thing that occurred is he lost his business. Didn't lose it because of some blunder that he had made or even because of a downturn in the economy. He was robbed. Some corporate raiders zeroed in on 3 of his businesses. In a matter of what seemed like hours, they had made their raids. And Joe was unprepared for it. He ended up stripped of everything he had. He was bankrupt, and he did not even have enough to start again at his beginnings. And yet, in spite of that, he did not flinch. His faith was strong. He'd often said that God was the chief executive officer in his business. God gave the business, and if God chose, he could take it away. And then a second thing happened. Joe's children had grown up and moved away. Joe prayed for them every day. It was his testimony that not a day went by that he did not bring them before God. Perhaps it was for that reason that his children remained close. And even if, after they had left home, they all moved to the same section of the country, made it a point to get together. They would find excuses to do so. They got together to laugh, to remember, to show pictures of their children. And once when one of Joe's daughters was having a birthday, the kids got together in the home of Joe's eldest boy. And while they were there celebrating the birthday, a tornado hit the community. It swept through the town as though it had eyes. It slammed into Joe's eldest son's house. The walls crumbled in, the walls and the roof fell. When the rescuers came, they discovered that Joe's 10 children were killed. It's hard to put into words the devastation that he felt. Wiped out in business was one thing, but to have his family wiped out was quite another. And yet, he held on to his faith. And then a third thing happened. Joe's health was affected. Those of you who are in counseling understand what went on. Holmes and Ray have that chart on stress, which they have assigned to events in our lives, both happy and sad, at certain points for stress. If you get 70 points, you can predict with almost uncanny accuracy that within a year you're going to have a physical illness. Well, with what happened to Joe, his numbers went off the charts. And he came down with a very dreadful disease. It was a skin disease, something like Hives, only it was far worse. He had boils from the top of his head to the tips of his toes. Excruciating pain. Couldn't walk, couldn't sit, couldn't lie down. Just had to sit still. When his wife saw the loathsome disease, and she had gone through all of this with him, she broke. She could not stand to see her husband suffer, and she suggested that perhaps the best thing he could do was to take his life. Always understand. She did not endorse suicide. But in this case, it seemed like her husband was suffering so severely that it was like a living death. And that taking his life seemed a reasonable thing to do. But Joe refused to do it. He was tempted, I suppose, but he believed that God was the giver of life, God would take life. And it would almost be a slap in the face of God to commit suicide. But the whole thing created a rift in their relationship. Fortunately, though, Joe didn't have to go through it alone. Joe had a network of friends that he had made across the years. Good friends who cared about him and cared for him. When they heard that he had lost his business and his family and his health, they didn't just send him a sympathy card. They came to be with him. They dropped everything. In fact, took time off from work in order to be by his side. When they saw him, it was more than they could take. And yet, they committed themselves to him. They decided that that he would not have to spend an hour alone. They divided up the time, and so they were with him 24 hours a day, 7 days of a week. And they just sat there. When you see somebody going through hell in his life, sometimes words are nothing more than a mockery. Only thing you can do is just be there. And so when he talked, they listened. When he needed something, they got it for him. They wanted to be friends. Chuck Rout has talked at times about an interesting relationship between pain and our inner clock. If you are in a skiing accident, you break your arm, you know it's going to hurt for a while, and the doctor says, look, it's going to take 7, maybe 8 weeks for you to get the use of it again. So even though you're frustrated, even though you're hurting, the inner clock works for you. You can handle it for 8 weeks. If you go to a dentist and the dentist runs out of Novocaine and he says, look, it's only going to take 60 seconds. You can bank on it. Well, he may be drilling to the roots of your nerves, but, you know, somehow 60 seconds, you hang in there. Pain and the clock work together. But there are times when the pain continues and the inner clock stops. You're suffering more than you ever thought you could suffer. At a time like that, you're no longer sick. You become sick and tired and disgusted. It happens even when you're sympathizing with people. As long as they seem to be improving, you can hang in there with them. But if the medicine, if the doctor, if God doesn't seem to intervene, after a while you find yourself drawing back. The pain goes on, but the inner clock is stopped. And apparently that's what happened with Job. This man who was noted for his faith, for his witness, seemed to come apart, it seems. When he began to talk, his talk was hot and violent. He wished he'd never been born. He felt the worst thing that ever happened to him was the day he saw the light of day. He felt that God had made a tragic mistake. And the more he talked, the more upset his friends became. I mean, they came because they wanted to comfort him, but they were also pious men. And this man who was so honorable and righteous was now, in these conversations of his, not only falling into a depression, but he was attacking his God and theirs. And they felt that they had to put the whole thing into perspective. And so they tried as best they could to offer an explanation. They said, as we might say, look, maybe God's trying to teach you a lesson. Maybe he's trying to get through to you. Sometimes there are lessons that we learn in the schoolroom of suffering that we can never learn in the playground of prosperity. Maybe if you just could learn the lesson, you could be sure that God would bring back your health and reestablish you again. Trouble was that Joe wasn't buying that. He didn't know of any lesson that he was learning. And if God wanted to teach him a lesson, then why didn't God come out and just teach the lesson? What was it, some kind of guessing game he had to play to decide what in the world he was supposed to learn out of all of this? Well, he said it, and he said it with anger, hostility. His friends heard it as a kind of verbal diarrhea. And then they realized that there may be something else going on. They realized that Joe may not be as righteous as he seemed. His kind of speech was a kind of a dead giveaway. It's one thing to be a saint when the spotlight is on you, but spotlight goes off when you're in the darkness. You can be a very different person. You may, up front, where people see you, be a godly man. But they suggested that perhaps in the deep recesses of his soul there was rebellion against God. There were things that he had failed to do or things that he had done that were an offense, and he needed to deal with them. He needed to confess his sin. He needed to make it right, and then God would forgive him. Joe didn't buy that either. Oh, he wasn't a perfect man, but he wasn't a wicked man. And he said to his friends, look, you know me. You know me as well as anybody. Can you charge me with anything? And if God's got something against me, why doesn't God come out and say it? I mean, if God's got something against me, why in the world doesn't he say it and let me answer? Because I'm a righteous man, and he refused to confess his sins. I guess that's why I came to like him. The kind of grudging admiration for Joe. He had enough integrity that he would not confess sins that he did not think were there. He didn't buckshot heaven, hoping that one of them would hit, and God would say, that's the one, now you're forgiven. No, he's just too good a man to do that. And it hurt his friendship. told his friends he thought they were theological quacks and the best thing he could do was keep their mouths shut. But they were pious men. They thought they had to do something to defend God. He ended up suffering all by himself. To help you to know that Joe's health has gotten better and he's got back on his feet again. But as I thought about that experience, it seemed to me that there were some lessons we could learn about the holy life from it. Have you ever watched television? Of course you have. Statistics are right, it's 23 hours a week. But there's a program on television called Matlock. It's about a defense attorney in the city of Atlanta. The program a while ago that began with a murder. Two men had killed another man. And then there was a short conversation in which it was clear that these two men were out to get Ben Matlock. They murdered this man in order to frame Matlock because one of the men had a brother that was in the penitentiary and Matlock had been responsible for putting him there. This was his way of getting back. Matlock would be framed and accused of the murder. He'd go to the penitentiary and perhaps even face death in the gas chamber. That came on at first, and then they rolled the credits, and then there was the commercial. But the first time we see Ben Matlock, he's in his office, and there are two policemen coming to arrest him. He's accused of murder. And the evidence is overwhelming. They found a gun, his gun, there at the scene of the crime with Ben Matlock's prints on it. And there was a letter from the man who had died saying that he felt that Ben Matlock was out to get him. As the story goes on, Ben Matlock knows nothing about what we know at the beginning of the drama. Here he is trying to find out why he's been accused of this crime and what kind of a frame-up it is and who did it. And we who know the beginning watch as he tries desperately to escape going to the penitentiary. The story I told you about Joe, I said I lived with him. I did not live with him in life, but I lived with him on the pages of the scriptures. I'm sure many of you have already guessed, it's the story of a man called Job. That story opens by saying, in the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. Forget what you have at the notes of your Bible. We don't know where Uz was. It may even have been a mythical land. We do not know where this took place. We do not know when it took place. Perhaps that was a deliberate device on the part of the author to tell us that this drama took place beyond time, beyond place. Because it's the story of a righteous man who suffered like hell, who tried to represent heaven. When we open the story of this man called Job, this very prosperous man, it's a rather strange scene. Evidently, according to the writer, the angels of God and God and Satan, who was called the accuser, all get together. The accuser has been walking down through the earth looking at the way things are, and he comes to stand before God, and the Lord says to Satan, "Where have you been?" Satan said, "I've been walking down throughout the earth." And then God says, "Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one on earth like him. He's blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." And then Satan asks the question, devilishly clever question. By that question, he impugns Job's goodness and God's wisdom. By his question, he makes Job into a fraud and God into a fool. He says, yes, I considered him. But does Job fear God for nothing? What are you saying is that Job is in it because of what he gets out of it? This whole thing is a big deal with Job. The only reason that he worships you, the only reason that he has an allegiance to you is because you protect him. But you take away his blessings, you take away his protection, and he'll curse you to your face. God buys into it. God says to Satan, let's see. You take away the things that are precious to him. See what he does. And so according to the story, Satan has a go at it. Job is robbed of his business and he's robbed of his family. Next scene, the accuser is back again and God brings up the same question. Says that, now, if you consider my man Job, nobody like him in all the earth. He's a righteous man. Jesus said, well, skin for skin. I mean, you take away his health, he'll curse you to your face. God buys into it again. Job is afflicted with the boils. Satan can do anything to him but take away his life. And that's where we meet Job on the pages of Scripture. Credits roll, the commercial's gone on, but when we meet Job, he's sitting there, devastated. He's lost his business, lost his health, lost his family, and lost the affection of his wife. And he's got his four friends. They don't know what's happened. Job doesn't know what's happened in heaven. Just goes through it. Satan's question is a great question. Satan knows that if he can drive Job away from God, then he has demonstrated that even holiness is selfishness. But the only reason we're in it is for what we can get out of it. And if he can prove that about the most righteous man on earth, then he has driven a wedge the size of a chasm between God and Job. And there's no possibility of God having anything to do with people on earth. So when we turn the page, we see Job. And we know what Job doesn't know. We know what's gone on in heaven. When people ask, what is the subject of the book of Job? That is, what's the book talking about? The answer is usually, it is the suffering of a righteous man. But I don't think that's accurate. Oh, the book is all about suffering. The suffering that is described, the suffering that's argued about through the book. But I don't think that's the subject. I think the subject in the book of Job is the faith of a good man in spite of suffering. It's interesting that the critics who have a go at Job do not believe that the first two chapters that describe what took place in heaven have anything to do with the rest of the book. From Job 3 on, you have exalted Hebrew poetry. And for the first two chapters, you have something that seems like a folk story. So they say the Hebrew doesn't seem to match up. And even more, they say, there doesn't seem to be any relationship between the first two chapters and what follows. I think the critics are wrong. I think they are dead wrong. If you don't have the first two chapters of Job, the scene that took place in heaven. The rest of Job is just four or five men sitting around discussing suffering, and all of them are wrong. Beautiful poetry, but kind of stupidity. Now, without the first two chapters, you don't realize that we are dealing with a man of faith who is going through suffering he does not and cannot understand. He can't understand it. If Job knew what went on in heaven, there would be no test. If Job had inside information, all bets are off. Job has to suffer and not know what's taking place. And because you and I know what happened at the beginning, we tend to read through Job very quickly. We read but we like to get to the end. We want to see who wins, Job or Satan. I mean, does Job stand up to the test and quit, curse God, or doesn't he? So we move through it, and we hardly realize, as Job is undergoing this, the kinds of things he's saying. He gets very close to blaspheming God. He is angry. He is furious. He can't understand. He wonders about God's goodness. He wonders about God's wisdom. He wonders about God's design. He wonders if God has hidden his face from him. All of that goes on, and we tend to miss it because we want to see whether Job holds on. And yet, God wins with Job. When you come to the end of the book, you discover that God speaks to Job. What's intriguing about God's conversation is that God never answers any of Job's questions. I mean, for 36 chapters, all you've got is questions and accusations, and God comes along and doesn't mess with any of them. Instead, God treats Job like a schoolboy taking an oral examination in a course the schoolboys never studied. God asks Job a series of questions, and the answer to each one is, I don't know. I don't know. Job, were you there when I created the world? No. Job, do you know how to create a universe? No. Job, would you be able to put the stars in heaven? No. Job, would you know how to handle the wind? No. Job, would you make a hippopotamus? No. Would you even think about making a hippopotamus? No. How about a crocodile, Joe? Would you make a crocodile? No. Would you ever think about making a crocodile? No. Question. The question is the question. When God comes to speak to Job, he does not accuse him of not being good. He does not accuse him of not being devoted, not being faithful, not being righteous. The only thing he faults Job for is his ignorance. And he is saying to Job, you know nothing about creating a universe. Get off your soapbox. Don't stand there telling me how to run my world. Job's greatest deficiency was that he was ignorant. The subject of the book of Job is how a man or a woman holds on to faith in the midst of suffering, even when they don't have a ghost of an idea of why it's taking place. And that's why Job is a man of faith. If you didn't know what we know in those first two chapters, and you read chapter 3 on, you'd wonder whether Job was a man of faith. You'd wonder whether Job was righteous. You would wonder whether Job was arrogant. If you didn't know what we know, you'd end up siding with Job's four friends. Job doesn't know what's taking place. He doesn't have any answers. He doesn't even know the questions. But in spite of it all, he holds on to God. Satan's bet was that if you put Job through an ordeal like that, he'll curse you to your face. And Job didn't do that. He argued, he wondered, he questioned. But he decided that even if God slew him, he would not give up on it. Whatever you mean by the holy life or the life of faith, sometimes that is where we are called to live it. Live it in the midst of apparent tragedy when we don't have a clue as to what's going on. Oh, there are some times in which Job's friends are right. There are some experiences that you go through in life that are teaching experiences. Things you learn about life you could learn in no other way. And you can see the lesson and it comes through to you. And sometimes the reason that we suffer is because we have handled life in a selfish and sinful way. You misuse life, it is a way of slapping back at you. And God doesn't overlook in believers what he condemns unbelievers for. Now, sometimes that's why we suffer. But there are other times in which we suffer and we do not know what is taking place. We do not know why it's going on. We have questions. We can become angry. We can be upset. And we can direct it all to God. Because the significant thing is that Job wanted to talk to God. And he never cast away from him. He was real enough, a man of integrity enough, to state his questions and to handle his doubts, but not turn his back on God. And sometimes the life of faith comes down just to that. It's bedrock. And that's where you have to live it. There's something else. It's almost ironic, isn't it? That when Job was going through his severe trial, standing out there on the stage, the property men came and took all the props. Took away his business, took away his family. Everything that gave him status. Then they got rid of all the characters. His wife got upset with him. His friends turned against him. And Job was going through this hell of a time by himself. Out there on the stage, he was all alone. But the ironic thing was that he wasn't alone. Out there beyond the footlights where he could not see, there was an audience of God and Satan and angels and demons who were holding their breath to see what that man all by himself would do in his relationship to God. That man in the land of Uz was himself the center of a cosmic drama in which the honor of God was at stake. I hope that there's not a time when God says to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Robinson?" I hope not. But if there is, I hope if that comes, as I'm sure sometime it will, that when I play in a drama whose lines and plot I don't understand, when suffering comes and it makes no sense to me, or somebody I love dearly is hurt, that's even worse, I want to trust God. I want to be a man of faith. The integrity of God rests on my faith, though I may wonder and argue and question. I want to hold on to God. Because the audience that's watching may be angelic hosts, demons, Satan, and God. And the suffering of a man or woman of faith may have a cosmic significance that they would never have thought about in their wildest dreams. Father, we live to ourselves, by ourselves, and for ourselves. Yet the Apostle Paul tells us that angels watch as we worship, and that God displays in his church to the principalities and powers and demonic forces his wisdom upon earth. Help us to understand that nothing we do is insignificant, that we belong to you, that being people of faith is not a trivial thing. Help us when we go through sufferings and we do not understand them to hold on to God. And if for some reason we cannot understand, you choose to slay us. Help us to trust you. For you are worthy of our trust. You alone are God.
We now continue with the discussion that followed the viewing of that video with Dr. Haddon Robison, and it will continue on side B.
He flirts with blasphemy at times, and I don't think they would have fully understood that. I think we always try to soften it, and then I don't think they would have understood the last part in which Job, as a man of faith, holds on to God. It's thin grass, but he holds on to God. Because he trusted what he could not trace, underwent what he could not understand. That part of it, I don't think that as a group they put that part, the book together that way. They knew the story, but I'm not sure that they really understood. That they understood the subject. They didn't understand the subject, and they didn't understand the book. So that's really what I thought perhaps was significant in the study of that book. If, however, they knew the subject of the book, then that was something else.
Am I right in saying that when you had your conclusion in view all the time, your big wrap-up, and the your close, the emotional close at the end, that you were able to stay on in the keep the tension that way? Confidence?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I felt that the most emotional part of the sermon for me was the last part. So that it reached an emotional climax. If you'd taken what I had at the end and put it, you know, 5 minutes in, you know, what else you could have done. In that sense, it was a climax.
Could you comment on the role that illustration you used about Matlock and the TV?
Okay.
And why you cut it off where you did and left it where you left it?
Good question. Yeah. Well, what I was trying to do was to set up in our day what was happening in Job, in the book of Job. And that you all have seen some kind of television drama where you and I are let in on something before the opening commercial that the people in the drama didn't know. So I was trying to draw that analogy, which would, I think, you know, I used Matlock, I could have used anything, in which that, it seems to me, to be the same phenomena in literature in Job. And I thought that it was stronger to make it out of the 20th century and out of television than it was to talk about ancient literature. So I think that's the device I was using. It is interesting that you mention that, because sometimes I hadn't thought about it until you said it, but sometimes you raise something like that, and especially if you set it up, people sit there and say, how did he get out of it? You know, tell me about... Yeah, tell me about Matlock. I had a friend who was preaching a sermon. I think I got this right. He was preaching a sermon, and in the course of the sermon, you know, he said, life is like a garden. There are some flowers that like roses that need the sunshine, and there are rhododendrons that need the shade. God knows what, you know, the good gardener knows what each one needs. So God in life, you know, puts some people in the shade. He said, oh yeah. Woman said to him, well, I really appreciate that message. I haven't been able to get my rhododendron to grow. You know, figure, well, forget it.
One of the things that struck me about the approach to that was the very subtle way that the application was brought through. I mean, I think that I tend to be very unsubtle in the application. Would you like to comment on that, Pat?
Yeah, there's quite a bit of evidence, and I think it may be true because of the way society is and the visual media, that you will gain more by indirection than by direction. Sermons that are filled with oughts and musts and shoulds don't make it. And it gets the element almost of scolding. And you sit there and, you know, your daughter or son's in church and, you know, we should, we must, we ought. And I think, what's wrong with daddy? I think there is an element to that. The more direct I am in telling you what you should do, the more likely you are to put up a defense and say no. The more it comes in the indicative mode rather than the imperative mode, where you're simply reporting, and people in a sense overhear it, the less likely they are to put up their guard. We know that to be true. The question of why it's true is... I think perhaps we use a great deal of that because that has been, in a sense, the form of preaching. But usually when you ask, when somebody says, don't preach at me, what they mean is, don't give me all kinds of oughts and shoulds. If you can present life to people and demonstrate kind of internal coherence about life, that this is the way it should be, this is the way it's lived, But not that, you know, you should live it, but this is the way it's lived. And if inside of you, you say, yeah, that makes sense. There's a tendency for us, you know, to respond. And I think it may be more true today than it's been in the past. But drama always works very seldom does the playwright step out in front of the curtain and then tell the audience what he was trying to get across and what they should do about it. Bound up in the drama is the message. And I don't know how many of you have seen the film Dances with Wolves. I don't know if it's Australia or not, but it is a superb film, 3 hours long. It has made a great impact in our country because it's one of the few films that's on the side of the Native Americans, the American Indians. And what it simply depicts is what happened back in our 1800s when the army went out and fought the Indians. But it looks at it from the point of view of the Indians. It's interesting how that film, all by itself, has changed the way many Americans look at our Native American population. We're about to celebrate the 500th anniversary of Christopher Columbus's discovering America. You'd think, you know, we'd really pop the champagne and blow the bugles about it, but a lot of people are saying, you know, we came over here and we drove the Indians out of their land and put them in plantations, in reservations. And it's really been softened. And a lot of it has to do with that film. It's called Dances with Wolves. But it's simply a narration. But it is also clear that Costner, the director, wanted to get across that message. But he lets the thing go on its own. It's dialogue, but it's the perspective is different. And suddenly you see something differently. And in seeing, if you want to change people's conduct, ultimately, you have to change their perspective. If you and I are walking along, and I say to you, be very careful, there's a poisonous snake over there, you respond. You change your perspective, you respond. If you're dealing with your Aborigines, I could preach a lot of sermons on what you should do with those Aborigines, what you must do with good Christians is what you should do. Until I can change your perspective about the Aborigines, I'm really not going to change your conduct. And so what you're really trying to do is to change perspective. If God had used it at all, to change your perspective about suffering you can't explain is to achieve what I wanted to achieve. I don't change the perspective, it doesn't work. Yes?
Yeah, I'll come back to the culture. I have a question. Your style is sort of a slow, meandering style, hanging little carrots in front of people, getting them to think about it, coming back to it. I'm really wondering, in many areas of our country, are in fact our people not reflective, not meditative, and in fact may come away from that thinking, nice story. Emotional heartstrings. I just wonder in fact, and I'm just interested in your comment or others' comment, whether in fact the Australian people really go strongly for that.
Yeah. I can't answer that. It's a good question. It may not... you would know that better than I. I suppose you'd have to ask, and I don't mean this in a funny way, were you touched by it? And if you were, I've gathered, you know, at least some of you are Australians. Maybe you're a special, no, maybe you are a special select group. I think there would be whole groups in the United States that I would be very reluctant to preach to that way. So I guess it would depend on the audience. Preaching, this was done a few while ago in a spiritual, we had a spiritual life week and I was asked to speak. But it was a seminary context. I think all of those, that was in my mind. In fact, my assistant chose these and the only ones we had on video, so I was kind of surprised to see it. It was the first time I've seen it, just watching it here. And I'm not sure I would have even selected it for this group, you know, if I had been thinking about it.
Can I ask at the end, which was a powerful ending, but why did you end without reference to Jesus, without reference to Christ? That's a question I'd have about the ending. You had at the end Job and then you moved to My Servant Robinson, but you don't end up coming to Christ in relation to Job.
Yeah, good question. I think I may be defensive in answering that. I think I would suppose that within the context that I was preaching, that there would have been a response to this as Christians. I think that would be maybe one answer. I also think that sometimes when I preach from the Old Testament, my sermons are not Christian enough. As I analyze them, and I think, though I did not necessarily think that of this one, there are others I've listened to, or, you know, gone back. I will take a tape 6 months after I preach when it's cold. I think, that was not a distinctly Christian sermon. It was true to the book, but obviously we preach the Old Testament in light of the New. I'm not sure, standing here, where I would have, how I would have developed it and brought it in. But I think that's a good. We preach from the other side of the cross, and so even the theology of the Old Testament has to be for us influenced by them. That's good. That probably is a weakness of that sermon, and I find that that's true when I preach some other books in the Old Testament. That there are times in which I think I bring in our Lord. Kind of show I'm still in the club, you know, not because it's an integral part of the sermon, but you know, I know I ought to. Reminds me of a woman at the Church of the Open Door in Los Angeles. I was preaching there. She said to me, I count the number of references to the blood of Jesus in the sermon. He said, now you referred to it three times, and I have found that men who refer to the blood of Jesus have God's anointing on it. I knew full well that I just lucked out that day. I mean, and there are times I think, without realizing, I think I put in references like that. Because I, you know, in a sense, I want to make them Christian, but whether they are an integral part of the sermon, I don't know.
Soap operas type of things here, and we have a number of them, they wax and wane in popularity. But the dramas are enormously popular with particular groups within our society. And it's interesting that at morning tea time, you sit down with people who've been watching it, and they would be analysing who said what to whom and why they said it. And so that even though these things are just TV rubbish, I know. That's treating them as almost real life situations.
Oh, yeah.
They're trying to understand what's going on. So I'm just wondering whether, in response to the question, whether maybe not necessarily that presentation, but a human drama is really where a lot of people are at.
Oh, I think, in the light of what television does to us today, there's no doubt that we move towards a story form. I think that's true in any culture of the Western world influenced by video, by movies or television. And you're right. I was at a church service a while ago. And they were, it was during the week, and they're having a prayer request. And one lady stood up, and she said, "I know this may sound a bit strange to you, but I watch a television drama called Guiding Light. And the main character, who's a good man, Mike, is undergoing an operation, and it looks like he may die. And I would appreciate it if you would pray for me." I mean, she had moved over out of reality to fantasy. What I will say is I'm sure there are a great many people who watch that for whom the mics of television have more evoked more compassion and concern and tears than the people in the real world. I mean, we live on that strange place. I was a visitor. So that, you know, some of you were moved to pray for Mike. Pray for him. Nobody did. I mean, what do you say? If you're a devout coward like I am, you practice your religion at a time like that.
When you're doing a story type sermon or a descriptive sermon in such as that, do you find it advantageous to get away from behind the pulpit preaching?
Yeah. And I stayed behind the pulpit. Usually I don't have a pulpit. I stayed behind the pulpit because it was one of the first tries we had at filming, and they wanted me to stay where the light was. And they knew if they took that away, I would move, and I did move anyhow. And but usually, I think it's far better not to have a pulpit. The conversation. A small pulpit like that isn't quite the problem that a huge one is. You get one of these, you know, monstrous things, it's like a fortress. And psychologically, you put a barrier between yourself and people that is very hard to climb. And sometimes you know, I go to a church, and this thing is huge, and invariably it was dedicated in the honor of somebody's mother who is a member of that church, and they couldn't move that. I mean, the walls of Jericho would fall before that would fall. And I said to the pastor, "Well, do you mind if you don't use the pulpit?" And he'll say, "Well, you can, but we don't have any other mics, you know, so there you are, you're stuck." Small pulpit doesn't get in your way because what you want with a pulpit is for people to see your whole body. The nonverbal communication is an extremely important part of communication. Anything that covers that, you know, creates problems.
Two things. One's an observation on some of the early comments. Thank you very much. I don't think that the fact that a person even knows the book well takes almost anything from a good sermon. I mean, it was my suffering at college to have to study Job quite a few times, and yet I found that, I still found it very, very helpful. If it's done properly, I don't think if they know it, it's like a sermon on John 3:16, I don't think that's of any issue that they've heard it. But my question, that was just a comment, my question is, I find it fairly frightening that you apparently did that sermon without notes. Is that what you're telling us? That you didn't have a bit of paper up there with an outline?
No, I didn't have paper.
And I really have trouble comprehending that. Are you going to...
Well, it looks like a feat of memory or something, but if you outline a sermon in terms of its movement, that sermon is a story. And you, the one thing that if you preach without notes that you have to do is you've got to be concrete and specific. You work with every memory system works with pictures. You want to remember someone's name, you try to, you know, look at the face and you paint a picture, or you make the name into a picture. So that if you want to remember something, you try to turn it out of an abstraction into a picture. It turns out that in communication, good communicators move from abstractions down the abstraction ladder to what is specific. At the same time as you're doing that, you're able to remember. If I stay on an abstract level for any length of time, I can't remember that. I am forced to deal with pictures. People think with pictures in their heads. So if you do that, the two tend to marry each other. And therefore, because you've got a series of pictures, you can keep in mind what you're doing. Of abstraction? Oh, what? Okay, if you're talking about abstraction, the person who says, it's almost impossible for me to do because of the way I think, but if a person says, we must seek the forgiveness of God. We must know that when we come to the Lord, out of His benevolence, He grants us His grace. And it is because of His grace that He deals with us as He does. God's, in fact, even there, I move it to He deals, but, you know, it's more like grace gives us the benevolence of God at the point of our deepest need. If we expect to understand God's working in our affairs, we must understand the place of faith. We must know the place of devotion. We must know that when we have our devotion to God, before that happens, the devotion of God has come to us. Okay, get a sermon on that level. You can't remember that. I don't even know what I was talking about. You might say, you stand in the need of forgiveness. You feel that need when you've been embarrassed by your sin. And you come to God and you wonder if God could forgive you. And when you come to ask His forgiveness, you discover that His forgiveness has been there since the time of the cross. You thought you were going to have to beg this from God, only to discover that God is a great giver. And He has given you forgiveness before you ever thought about it.